From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, as the state legislature prepares to start work for the new year, we'll meet two new state representatives.
I'm feeling energized and excited and a little bit nervous, but I think that's a good thing. It keeps you on your toes.
I am just eager to get started. I feel like this first day has been coming for so long.
How the people of Bolivia can teach us lessons in meeting our water challenges.
When I say the people, I mean across class, across culture, communities come together and they meet to work out their water challenges.
Encouraging news on dementia rates, they're going down and education plays a role.
People who have the opportunity to have education early in life and throughout life seem to have better health outcomes too.
Those stories and more. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. So glad you're with us today. More than 40 new lawmakers start their first day of work in Lansing tomorrow. We're going to speak with two of them this hour as we introduce new elected officials all through the week. Also, just what happens when a basic utility like water is privatized? We'll look at lessons that we can learn from one effort in South America. But first, Betsy DeVos was supposed to go before a Senate committee tomorrow in Washington, but the confirmation hearing for her appointment as Education Secretary has been postponed. Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta is with us now from Washington. Rick, what happened? Why was the hearing delayed?
As they were getting ready to roll forward with this, Senate Democrats were putting up a fight that they were saying that before this hearing goes forward, that there should be a more thorough ethics review, that they wanted to see more of the paperwork that Betsy DeVos would file. And the Republicans gave in and said, we're going to give it another week. Now, was it just because of that? Probably not. We know that the Senate leadership and the Trump administration, the incoming Trump administration, were really trying to process a lot of controversial confirmations through the process very, very quickly. And this, as much as anything else from what I'm hearing, is an acknowledgement that maybe it was just too much too soon.
And am I correct? Betsy DeVos has not yet cleared her ethics review?
It's not been finalized that she's turned in a lot of the paperwork, but a lot of the answers to how are you going to resolve this particular quandary or that particular quandary are, I will work with the ethics office to come up with a solution. And Democrats are saying that they want some more concrete answers on that, which, of course, is also what a confirmation hearing is for.
And we know the new confirmation hearing date is January 17th.
January 17th, that will be taking place in the United States Capitol on the same day that the State of the State speech is taking place in the State Capitol, and also with the inauguration of the new president looming.
I think you need to clone yourself, Rick Pluta. Well, Rick, we know that some Democrats are really going hard at DeVos qualifications. Senator Elizabeth Warren released a 16-page letter she sent to Betsy DeVos. Among many things she wrote, there's no precedent for an education department secretary nominee with your lack of experience in public education. Does this postponement give any further ammunition, if you will, to those who are opposed to this DeVos nomination?
None of the Democrats I've talked to are operating under the impression that they think they can actually block the Betsy DeVos nomination. But what they are hoping they can do is maybe take a bite out of her agenda and make it, call it into question, the things that maybe she would like to accomplish. And conversely, on Team DeVos, that this confirmation hearing isn't just about surviving the process. It's also about selling that agenda and her vision for inducting more school choice into the system.
I'm guessing we could expect to hear some interesting back and forth at the confirmation hearing on the 17th.
We will hear a lot of back and forth about what the experience with school choice charter schools has been in Michigan, not to mention Betsy DeVos and the DeVos family's efforts to adopt vouchers in Michigan. You'll remember that ballot proposal that failed years ago. That was a DeVos brainchild, and that will certainly be brought up again in this process.
And then all wrapping up with the confirmation vote, which at this point is scheduled for January 24th.
That's right. And it's looking like Betsy DeVos will face that vote without the support of Michigan's senior United States Senator Debbie Stabenow. Gary Peters, the junior senator, who's also a Democrat like Stabenow, is meeting with DeVos later this week. He won't talk about his vote until after that meeting.
Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta with us now from Washington. Thanks, Rick.
Always a pleasure.
Time to talk about beer, specifically women and beer. That's the focus of an event happening tomorrow night at the new Arcadia Ales Brewery and Tap Room in Kalamazoo, when Ginger Johnson will enlighten one and all on the rich relationship between women and beer. Ginger's the founder of Women Enjoying Beer and the author of the book, How to Market Beer to Women, Don't Sell Me a Pink Hammer, and she's with us now. Ginger, I know you're being brought in by the group Fermenta, which is all about boosting the involvement of Michigan women in the craft beverage industry. What is fueling this growing interest?
Sure. So, you know, the great thing about Fermenta, Cindy, is that they are open to everybody, by the way. It started as a women's collective. At the same time, they realized that everybody needs to be in the conversation, which is absolutely a fundamental of how I operate. If we're not all talking about it, nobody's making progress. Women have always been involved in beer. I think it's hilarious, Cindy, that people think that this is a new thing or it's a trend or that it's clever or that it's a niche. No, don't use the N-word, please. Women have always been involved in beer. Women used to be the beer makers because brewing is cooking. So you and I would be the ones over the stove or the hearth. In fact, here's a little bit of trivia. You know that profile of a, quote, witch over a cauldron?
Yes.
That didn't really come from the witches. That came from women in the homes. That's the hearth. That's the food being prepared. The hat keeps her warm. The cat keeps the rodents out of the food stock. So there's a whole bunch of things that we can shatter and throw to the curb and get everybody going forward together. Craft is an interesting word. It's one I actually don't use myself. I think it's if something is well-crafted, then we're all going to be able to enjoy it, and everybody has their own definition of that. So,
yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. Where,
Ginger, did this stereotype of, you know, the guys popping a cold beer and the ladies cracking open a bottle of wine, where did that come from?
Oh, I would love to know, Cindy. What I do know, what I can extrapolate from my years of research and seeing lots of ads and so forth, is that when the United States went into Prohibition, when that was enacted in 1920 with the Volstead Act, we really changed the entire landscape of what alcohol was overall in this country. And we started going more towards the illicit spirits. So what that did was so many things, but one thing that affected was our palate. We were drinking alcohol that was either poorly made, poisonous sometimes, illicit in all facets. And what did we do to make that actually drinkable? We mixed it with a lot of things that were sweet. So we collectively influenced the palate of everybody by having all these cocktails. You know, people talk about the Prohibition cocktails, the old fashioned, the sidecar, all those kinds of things. Well, some of that harkens back to during Prohibition and then repeal. Well, then when we came into repeal, when everything changed, we had one to two generations of people who didn't know what beer could taste like because they literally hadn't had commercially legally produced beer. So, you know, it's a whole bunch of stuff that we've had to reconcile and realize in how we move forward with beer. So why do we show images of men popping a top and women drinking a bottle of wine? I don't know. That's still a mystery because there are some ads that have women fully engaged in drinking a beer.
And you have said, Ginger, that beer companies don't completely and respectfully market beer to women. How should beer companies go about attracting and welcoming women as consumers and also as part of the industry?
Females in America influence fully 75 to 85 and sometimes north percentage of all purchases in America. So every category, products, goods, service, whatever it might be, Cindy. So first of all, I like to frame it that it's opportunity. We don't need to thrash anybody with some wet grain, but we sure do need to wake people up to the realization that what fuels our country is our economy, and the economy is fundamentally directed by women. So when beer companies fully recognize that as a full respect person and nothing to do with our reproductive systems, then we're making more progress. So what do they need to do? They need to focus on flavor. My book that's just out, How to Market Beer to Women, Don't Sell Me a Pink Hammer, I talk about some of the top concerns of women, the top interest points, the top areas where any brewery can excel by taking a look at the fact that, first of all, more than 50% of the global population in the human realm is female. So let's fully address that. Why wouldn't you is the counter question. But when we do that, then we can really see some marked improvement in our business. We can see greater progress in our communities overall. I don't think I'm being overdramatic when I, you know, this is the kind of world peace direction, because when we're all sitting around the table and having a beer, things go smoother. More conversations happen and more progress happens because we can come together over something. So let's bring more people together to come together for the future.
In the last minute we have, Ginger, I'm just curious, what does your research show you that women really want from their beer? Are our taste buds far apart from the guys?
That's a great scientific question. I wouldn't deign to comment on that. I'm not a scientist, but what I can tell you is I would question some of the reports that have come out that said, well, women are better tasters. I don't think that's the point anyway, Cindy. The point is making sure that beer feels fully accessible and welcoming and inviting to everybody, every make and model, color, brand, orientation. That's what we need to focus on. And when we do that, that's where we see the magic of progress.
Ginger Johnson will be presenting her story, the story of women in beer, at the New Arcadia Ales Brewery and Taproom in Kalamazoo. It's from 7 to 9 tomorrow night. I know there's going to be a beer mini pairing and tasting, cheese, chocolate, and beer, which I think is fascinating. And you can find out more and get tickets by going to fermentamichigan.org. That's fermentamichigan.org. And Ginger Johnson, founder of Women Enjoying Beer and author of the book, How to Market Beer to Women, Don't Sell Me a Pink Hammer. It was fun to talk with you, Ginger. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cindy. What a ball. Cheers.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. As America's baby boomers go marching into their senior years, there has been good reason to wonder and worry if we'll all be coping with large increases in the number of people with dementia. But here's some encouraging news. A recently published study finds dementia rates in this country have dropped between 2000 and 2012. The lead author of that study is here with us now to tell us more. Dr. Ken Lange is with the University of Michigan, where he's a professor in the Department of Internal Medicine, and he's associate director of the Institute of Gerontology. Your study finds dementia rates are declining. By how much, and how did you learn this?
Well, we used a large study that's based at the University of Michigan called the Health and Retirement Study, where we've been following a large number of adults in the United States, about 20,000 adults, 50 and older, since the early 90s. So we used information from that large study to try to understand how many people in 2000 who were 65 and older in the United States had dementia, and compare that to how many had dementia in 2012. And what we found was there was a decrease, as you said, in the prevalence of dementia from about 11.6% down to about 8.8%.
And that's statistically something to really pay attention to.
It is, yeah. It's a pretty significant finding. Obviously, any decline in this kind of condition is going to be a good thing for families and for public health. It is a relatively large decline. It is in line with a number of other studies that have been done in the United States and other countries. So it does seem as though there's more evidence that this optimistic trend does seem to be happening both in the United States and other high-income countries around the world.
So what gets credit for this?
Yeah, so it's a fascinating puzzle, I think. Obviously, the brain is a complicated organ, lots of influences, both medical, social, environmental. There's two things that we and other researchers have been focusing on. One is a large increase in education level. So actually, older adults in the United States born more recently have been going to school longer. Basically, after World War II, there was public policies directed at increasing educational attainment in the United States and other places around the world. So for instance, in our study in 2000, people who were 65 and older had about just under 12 years of education on average. Just in that 12 years or so, that average increased by almost a full year, so up to almost 13 years of education.
And I think a lot of us would be startled to hear you say higher education seems to be linked with declining rates of dementia. Why do you think that is?
Right. And again, there's a number of theories, and I don't think we have the perfect answer yet, but I think a number of studies, both in animals and in humans, suggest that the more you use your brain, especially earlier in life, as it's getting wired up and the connections between brain cells are getting set and adjusted, the more you use your brain to think about complex things, the more you're interacting with the world in ways that you know, keep you interested, sort of the stronger your brain becomes.
You're using the muscle.
Using the muscle, yeah. I think that's a, not a bad analogy.
Yeah.
The term, the jargon we use in the neurological world is cognitive reserve, this idea that, again, the more you're using your brain as it's wiring up, the more reserve you're building into it, in some ways like a muscle.
Certainly there's something to be said for early childhood education and attention to that with what you're saying, because aren't we the most open to everything then?
Absolutely. I think in many ways education policy and expanding education is in many ways a health policy too, as you're saying. I think early life education has been shown to have a large range of positive effects on people's health, not just on the brain, as we're talking about here today, but in many other areas too, sort of cardiovascular risks, hypertension. Still trying to sort out exactly what the connections are between that, but I think there are pretty good evidence that people who are have the opportunity to have education early in life and throughout life seem to have better health outcomes too.
I'm talking with Dr. Ken Lange of the University of Michigan, where he's an associate director of the Institute of Gerontology, about his recently published study finding that dementia rates in the United States have dropped between 2000 and 2012, and that tracks along with studies that have been done elsewhere. And there's also evidence we are doing a better job, aren't we, of controlling and treating diseases that seem to lead to dementia, such as?
That's right. There seems to be a close connection between the heart and the brain, mm-hmm. the cardiovascular system. So obviously the brain requires blood and good blood flow to do its job and to stay healthy. So that anything that sort of affects blood flow, things like high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, things like that, all of those not only seem to have a bad effect on the heart, but also on the brain. So it's a bit of a mixed picture. Even though we have had increases in high blood pressure, obesity, diabetes over the last 20 or 30 years, it does seem that we're doing a bit better job of treating those conditions in a way that decreases their bad outcomes. So treating blood pressure, blood pressures, again, in high-income countries around the world have been dropping over the last few decades. Diabetes getting a bit better controlled. High cholesterol also getting a bit better controlled.
This does seem encouraging. I've got to ask, are we baby boomers, because I'm of that generation, are we getting a payoff finally for years of really trying to watch what we eat and work out and not smoke? Is that kind of landing on this?
I think so. Again, I can't say that we are. We have the final word. These are complicated relationships, as we're talking about. But I certainly believe that, and the patients that I work with, I talk with them about that, the importance, again, not that it'll just decrease your heart risk by doing the things you said, especially physical activity, keeping blood pressure well controlled, having a good diet. All of those seem to be important. Another interesting sort of complicated issue around this is that it does seem it's in middle age when those issues are most important for decreasing the risk later in life. So having your blood pressure controlled, you know, in your 30s to 60s, obesity well controlled, or staying a healthy weight in those years, it seems like it's then that those conditions can have an especially significant impact in the brain. And it could be actually, and this is some of the complicated issues here when looking at this topic, that as you get older and sort of in your 70s or 80s, many studies are actually showing that having a bit of extra weight and having your blood pressure a little higher, that might actually be more healthy than having it on the lower side. So again, there seems to be a changing relationship between these conditions and how you treat them and their impact on the brain.
And it also strikes me that amongst the baby boomers, we are not retiring perhaps as early as our parents. So we're still in there slugging, if I might put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
You think that makes a difference too, in the sense you're not kind of retiring with whatever that may entail, where perhaps you're not as actively involved with complex things?
Right. No, I think that's a great question. And actually some colleagues at the University of Michigan have been studying that question specifically. Does working longer and working at what kinds of jobs longer protect your brain? And it does seem as though there's some evidence that in some international comparisons with the data that we have in the United States and data in Europe, we think jobs that are keeping you interested and that are keeping your brain engaged and allowing you to kind of interact with the world in a good way are more likely to be beneficial long term than a job that obviously isn't keeping you interested, and that might actually, retiring from that job might actually allow you to do some things that keep you healthier too.
Fascinating work and encouraging news with dementia rates from Dr. Ken Lange, University of Michigan Institute of Gerontology and professor in the Department of Internal Medicine. It was great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
At noon tomorrow, state lawmakers begin the new session. There are 43 new members entering the 110-member State House of Representatives. Among them, my next guest, Republican Beth Griffin, the new representative for the 66th District in the Michigan House. She is with us now. So you're about to start your first day as a state representative. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling energized and excited and a little bit nervous, but I think that's a good thing. It keeps you on your toes.
You always hear from great, great performers that step onto the stage that if you don't have some butterflies, you shouldn't be doing it. So that sense of kind of anticipation and excitement.
Right, right. I agree with you 100%. It's good to be grounded and it's good to stay on your toes.
Not everyone may be familiar with the 66th District. It's all of Van Buren County and a little bit of Kalamazoo County.
Correct. It's all of Van Buren, which stretches from just a little bit west of Kalamazoo all the way to South Haven. And then it is Alamo and Cooper counties in North Kalamazoo, including the city of Parchment, where I used to teach middle school.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. I think that's a very fascinating aspect of what you're bringing to your new job as a state representative. What do you see as the biggest issues in your district?
Well, for us, I think we have a lot of great business, including agribusiness and farming, and tourism is also huge in the South Haven area, manufacturing. So for us, and luckily this is something that I'm hearing echoed around the state with other representatives, jobs are our number one priority right now, helping businesses that are already in existence to grow, reducing overburdensome regulations on the businesses that are stifling growth at this time, and also attracting new businesses into the district so that we can continue to be healthy and keep those kids attending those schools and keep those families spending money in the district. And raising healthy families makes for a happy district. And I understand how all those things tend to interconnect. And that sort of keeps me grounded. And that's where I'll start.
I'm wondering about, as you think of the next 2 years and the goals you have, what are those, not necessarily just in legislation, but in the way you're going to represent your district?
Well, I think because I was a local official for 4 years prior to this, staying connected in the district and listening to families, listening to businesses, listening to their stories and their concerns and their celebrations and their successes has enabled me to really step back and to look at it through their eyes and to understand that we all may be a little different, but we all want to be successful. We want to be able to raise families, and we all want job options for our children when they graduate from high school. So really, even though we may have different jobs, we all want to raise families and get along and not get bogged down in differences, but work together. And so I think when I first started my campaign, I really honed in on working together for a better Michigan because it just felt right. It still feels right. And using common sense solutions that I think sometimes come a little more obviously to teachers can be applied to politics as well. And doesn't make it easy, but it helps keep you grounded. And I think as long as we're all working together, we can come up with much better solutions because good politics always starts with working together and making good decisions together, I think.
Which sounds very much like probably the lessons you were teaching when you were a middle school teacher and you were telling your class.
Right. We want you all to work together. And that doesn't mean you're best buddies with everyone in your group, but, you know, good solutions and good projects and good change happens when everyone's at the table.
Representative, with your experience as a teacher, your master's in education, what kind of voice do you feel you will bring to legislative debates about the future of education in our state?
Well, I think as a teacher, I'm used to, it may sound strange, I'm used to doing a lot with a little. And you know, honestly, in the last 20 years, teachers have increasingly done more with less. It's kind of a necessary evil, if you will. It's a very demanding job. But teachers don't go into education to make a lot of money. They go into education because they love kids and they want to teach. And I truly do think like an educator, and I'm used to stretching my own personal money sometimes to buy supplies in the classroom. And so I think that common sense approach is helpful. And as teachers, we have to work together with a lot of different people all at one time. It's called the classroom. So I just, you know, I think that politics sometimes can be difficult, but problem solving is the same. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Representative, what is your sense of how lobbyists work in Lansing?
Well, lobbyists are paid to be your friend. So it helps to understand that you have friends and you have family and you have colleagues. And due to term limits, I think that some lobbyists will do a great job helping to educate you on an issue and then may explain both sides and may help grow you as a new legislator. And I'm certainly aware of that. But it helps to remember that even though we do have term limits and we do have to bone up on issues quickly, it helps to remember that lobbyists are as diverse as teachers are, they're as diverse as legislators are, and there are good ones and there are not so good ones. And you just have to keep your eyes open and understand, you're still going to operate from your principles. You're still going to keep your district, on your heart, and your stories of your families very much in the forefront of your mind, so you can make sense out of what ones you want to listen to and what ones you can learn from and what ones sort of align with the wishes of your district.
Representative, what's your impression of your soon-to-be colleagues on the other side of the aisle and the Michigan Democratic Party? I'm wondering what issues in particular you think you can work with them on.
Well, actually, as a new legislator, we've had a few opportunities to get to know some of the incoming Democratic representatives, and I've met several of them. I think, as a new legislator going in, I think that there are some good things that we can start working on quickly. Among those things, I think, are the issue of job training and enhancing different types of skills training to fill the jobs skills gap that exists. It's not just in one sector. It's a problem that I'm hearing, and I alluded to this earlier just a bit. It's a challenge that we have all across the state. It's not just in the 66, it's in Detroit too. And I think it was kind of neat to be talking with Democratic new legislators and realize that this is a problem that affects us all. And so I have high hopes for that. I think, the trick will be getting around the table and figuring out what works well and figuring out what it is, the how. How are we going to do that? That'll be interesting. But if it's a problem we all share, then, that's half the battle.
Who comes to mind, Representative, in the legislature as a model or someone who could be something like a mentor to you as you you have to hit the ground running, and at the same time, you are really learning the ropes?
Well, as an educator, I look at many different people and think, wow, I can learn that from them. Representative Dave Maturin from the Kalamazoo area is an expert in tax policy. And, so I look to him. I look to Tanya Shoemaker, Senator Tanya Shoemaker, and she has a lot of wisdom to share. I think that, I truly look at many different legislators and try to find something in them that I can learn about. And I think that's how you become effective. You make connections with everyone and you find common ground and find new things that you can learn from. And all of it is, again, geared towards helping people in your district, helping you be a better legislator and realizing that you're not going to learn all that on your own. You have to reach out and figure out who the people are that perhaps share similar districts and ally with them and learn from them as well.
How will you measure success in your new job?
Oh, absolutely. I would measure success by how accessible and effective and accountable I am directly to the people in my district. You just have to stay grounded. You have to stay responsible to concerns of families in your districts, staying on top of concerns that come in through the office, making sure people are taken care of, and just it's common sense to me. It's being responsible to the people that got you to Lansing. They voted for me. I owe them that. And I need to do my best to be accountable and to be accessible and to be consistent. And I think as long as I do that, I'll be good.
Beth Griffin is the new Republican representative from Michigan's 66th District. Representative, thank you so much for speaking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There'll be an historic moment this week as the new State House begins its work. For the first time ever, people in Dearborn will be represented by an Arab American Muslim. Abdullah Hamoud is the new Democratic representative for the 15th District, and he's with us right now. Welcome, Representative Hamoud. Are you getting tired of hearing that title yet?
I am... It's not tired. Just different.
It is different. And I want to talk a little about how you were elected to the State House. My understanding is you really didn't run as a Muslim candidate or as an Arab candidate. You ran as Dearborn's candidate.
Exactly. You know, certainly I am, you know, first generation Muslim Arab American. But, you know, I am a proud product born and raised in the city of Dearborn. And the city of Dearborn provided my family with everything from, you know, social opportunities to financial freedom. And that was my messaging, that I'm from this community, the Dearborn community, for that community.
And you're 26 years old, and that's kind of on the young end for a state representative. What do you believe you're bringing to this job of representing some 89,000 people?
Yeah, I think there's a tenacity. Certainly, if you look at my campaign as a reflection for how I would be as a legislator, certainly the hardest working candidate, and I believe I bring that same mindset up to Lansing. Additionally, I have an extensive background in health policy and environmental policy, and I certainly bring those lenses with me. But more than anything, I think I'm a great communicator. I'm willing and able to work with individuals, you know, on both sides of the aisles and with all stakeholders to really come up with the best possible solution to address the issues at hand.
What made you decide, all right, I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to plunge into the process of running for this office? Because there had to have been a lot of things that had to click into place to bring you to this point.
Yeah, there are really two big reasons for why I ran for office. One is I truly believe that policy is a lever for change, just being in the policy world for the last several years. And this opportunity to be state representative was a way to make sure that the next generation has greater opportunities than I ever had. And secondly was the passing of my older brother. You know, it happened in October of 2015, and he was my biggest advocate. And so in some way, shape, or form, I am an advocate for my community in the same way my brother was an advocate for me. And I thought that was a way of continuing his legacy and putting to work all the values he really instilled in me.
So here you are, about to start your first day as a state representative. What are your feelings right now?
I am just eager to get started. I feel like this first day has been coming for so long. And I'm excited to get through the ceremony, excited to find out the committee assignments, and really begin the work of a legislator, you know, building coalitions around issues and addressing the problems at hand.
And what do you see as the biggest issues in your district in Dearborn?
Certainly in Dearborn, there are several. The health is certainly one, the environment and education. When it comes to health, we can talk about, you know, opiate abuse and substance and drug use addiction. We can talk about the accessibility of mental health services, the affordability of healthcare. Look at the intersection of the health and the environment. You know, I have a very strong public health background, and looking at the intersection of environment and healthcare is very important. When it comes down to the environment, you can look, you know, with a 15-minute drive in Dearborn, your likelihood of asthma dramatically and significantly increases because of the quality of the air in the south end of Dearborn. So trying to work with corporations and factories and entities to ensure that they're working within the environmental regulations, keeping the jobs in Dearborn, but also ensuring that we push forth a sound environmental policy that's great for the environment, great for the health of the residents, and great for the economy.
And as we talk, you know, your first day has not arrived, but I'm sure you've spent time thinking about what some of the challenges are going to be that you're going to face. What do you think some of those biggest challenges might be?
Some of the biggest challenges will be to put aside the partisan politics and trying to build coalitions on both sides of the aisle so that we find the best possible solution to address the issues at hand. You know, you cannot get anything done by yourself up here. You know, that's a lesson people have already told me about, and I want to make sure that I'm, you know, being proactive.
Yeah, in fact, I'm wondering what kind of impression you've been building of your soon-to-be colleagues on the other side of the aisle in the Michigan Republican Party.
Yeah, in orientation, you know, with the various legislative sessions that have brought us up to speed on working as a legislator and kind of the ins and outs, I think I've been building great relationships with individuals on both sides of the aisles, Democratic as well as Republican. And hopefully I want to carry those relationships forward and continue to build them. You know, if there are certainly co-sponsorship opportunities, to reach out, to be proactive and have conversations, you know, seek the input of, you know, Republicans as well as Democrats on legislation that my team and I plan on drafting. I truly believe if everybody feels like they had a say in the legislation that is being proposed, it'll be easier to pass.
Have you got bills in mind already?
We certainly have a few bills in mind. Still early, and, you know, we're trying to work out the timeline, trying to see what's Speaker Leonard and the Republican caucus has in regards to bill packages, as well as, Leader Singh and our leadership in the Democratic Party, the bills and packages they have in mind. That's all still yet to be determined.
It's a little premature to ask what areas these bills are going to be in.
I mean, I think there certainly will be a focus in health policy and environmental policy, as well as education. Ensuring, when it comes down to education, I'm a big advocate of universal early start, especially in regards to my district, the city of Dearborn, as well as just ensuring that we no longer slash funds away from public education. I'm trying to protect and preserve the funding that we have while trying to add more, too.
Representative, what issues in particular do you think stand the greatest chance of bipartisan cooperation?
Policy regarding mental health issues, substance and drug use addiction, that seems to be an issue that legislators on both sides of the aisles have expressed an interest in, as well as the Lieutenant Governor, as well as the governor and individuals on both sides of the party have expressed interest in skills trade and vocational training within our schools and trying to link it to our economy to create more jobs and more opportunities. I think those two ideas will be at the forefront in regards to bipartisanship, or at least I hope so.
What is your sense, Representative, of how lobbyists work in Lansing?
Certainly, they are there to represent the diverse needs of their clients. They oftentimes have input and information that can be useful when you're trying to either draft legislation or seek answers regarding legislation that has been introduced in the House or the Senate. So certainly want to utilize them where you can, because they're very well a part of Lansing. Best to work with them as opposed against them.
Who comes to mind in the legislature as a role model or someone anywhere who could be something like a mentor to you as you learn the ropes?
Certainly along this process, there have been several individuals from my community as well as from Lansing. When it comes to individuals in Lansing, Senator David Kinesic has been a great friend and a great mentor when it comes down to learning the ropes. But also, from my community, his previous representative, George Duraney. He has been a great mentor, especially when it comes down to the issues pertinent to the district and the city of Dearborn. Certainly been working closely with him, with his former staff as well, and will continue those dialogues and relationships.
Well, you've got a historic week ahead, and we will be certainly hoping to be able to check in with you as your term progresses and see what's working for you and what your thoughts are. We really appreciate you taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you so much again for having me. Look forward to it.
Democratic State Representative Abdullah Hamoud, representing the 15th District in the Michigan House. We here in the Great Lakes State have pretty much been able to take water for granted. But the Flint water crisis, coupled with 70,000 households in Detroit having their water shut off, these have forced Michigan to confront water issues in a way we really never have before. To help us learn from these water crises, my next guest thinks it's a good idea for us to look to the south, to Bolivia. That's where people fought back and won against corporate water control. Valerie Vandepan is the former editor of the Metro Times. She contributes to the Columbia Journalism Review, the Boston Globe, and Politico, among many publications. Her guest column in Model D Media is titled, What Michigan Can Learn from Bolivia's Water Crisis. Valerie, welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
Why can Bolivia teach us a few things about water?
Because the people of Bolivia have been thinking about water for decades and understand and appreciate its value. When the water was privatized there, their rates skyrocketed and they protested. They stopped paying their bills. They fought, literally, physically fought the military and the police. And eventually the water privatization was broken. The water was returned to the people. And they've been valuing it differently ever since.
In fact, the way you describe in your column in Model D Media, I mean, people died. This was really,
yes,
really a hard-fought battle.
Absolutely.
But that was just step one. You say then the work began to make sure that people in Bolivia had access to safe and affordable water. What's that work been like? What's happened since?
So it's a very romantic story when you talk about, all these people rose up and they fought a multinational corporation and they won the right to their water, which is very romantic. But in reality, that was only the beginning. I think it's important, though, to understand that the Bolivian people by nature understand water is a basic human right. They're coming from a place where the fundamental culture of the people believes everybody needs water and has a right to access that water, which is a different place that they're starting from than from, for example, in Michigan, where that issue is still highly contended.
Well, in fact, as you touch on the mindset of people in Bolivia towards the poor and underprivileged, it made me remember, for example, whenever the Detroit Free Press or the Detroit News would run a story about the water shutoffs in Detroit, you go through the reader comments and find things like, well, go get a job, pay your bill, or let them put a hose in the Detroit River and get their water that way. But you found very different attitudes in Bolivia towards the poor and the underprivileged.
Right. So there, no one would say something like that in Bolivia. And when you talk to people about water in Bolivia, everybody there has a very sophisticated understanding of it. And they look at it through the lens of, you know, the government isn't able to provide all of our needs. There aren't jobs for everybody. There are class issues. So, for example, there's an understanding that if you're a wealthy family, you need water and you can afford to pay for it. But if you're an elderly single man, you're probably feeble and you can't afford to work. Or, you know, there's no job for you to have. Or if you're a single mother with many young children, you're very poor, you still have a right to water, but you cannot afford to pay the same amount as a wealthy family. So what's most interesting is that across the board, there's this understanding that some people have a bigger capacity to pay or to contribute than others, and people are willing to do that in order to ensure that everybody there has a right to that water.
Valerie, so what's happening today? Here we are 17 years after these protests in Bolivia that restored control of water to the public, in a sense, and got rid of that international consortium. Who controls water today?
So now it's a mix between public. When I say public, I mean the people and the government, which also, you know, contributes to these water systems. But the water systems are very much in the hands of the people, and the people come together. And when I say the people, I mean across class, across culture, communities come together and they meet to work out their water challenges. Every community has a different solution. Some of them are similar, some of them are very different, but they all come together to create their own solutions to provide for their own water. Rainwater capture is very common. People will dig their own wells. They will install their own pipes to transport the water. They will use converted car engines to pump the water from the ground, and then they'll lay pipe and let gravity transport the water once it's to the surface. There's so much innovation. Everyone using rainwater capture, even if you just use the rainwater you're capturing simply to flush the toilet, you're making use of a resource and bettering your community.
And isn't it true that, you know, here we are surrounded by water in Michigan? We, by and large, haven't let ourselves worry and ask questions about what's coming out of the tap. I mean, we're the water wonderland. So what are questions about water that people are asking in Bolivia that you believe we should be asking here in Michigan?
You know, who has the water? Is it the people's water or is it the state water? What can we do better? What is the solution? And if everybody asks, you know, for example, in Flint, what can we do to get water? What can we do to get fresh water? Who is responsible for the water? Is it our responsibility as a community, or is it the state's responsibility? And my sense is in Michigan, there's this idea that it's the state's responsibility. But the state has failed spectacularly in its control of the water and is continuing to fail spectacularly when it comes to Michigan's water. And Michigan is such a fantastic source of fresh water. It's the largest source of fresh water on earth. And we can't just keep repeating that statistic to each other as Michiganders. We really need to take action, and we do need to come together as a community and preserve the water that we have, keep it clean, and develop new systems for distribution of that fresh water to the people, because you cannot live without water.
And as you say in your piece in Model D Media, you can take different interests, put them together, and fight for the water, and everybody doing that together. Do you believe we can do that in Michigan?
I would like to think we can. You know, there there was this great story that was told to me about there were these retired engineers. They were older Bolivians. They were all retired, but they had all been engineers. And they started working with a community to design and develop a water system for the community. And, you know, these people, nobody's being paid to develop these systems. It's not like these are jobs that are being created. These are people coming together to work together, to contribute their time to the community so that the entire community can live better. And I think that cross-class and that cross-generational commitment to something so basic is very healthy for people. You know, and this is an ongoing. This isn't a, okay, we're going to do this and it's done. This is a constant thing, you know, where, you know, how do you foster collective participation of people with different interests? How do you mobilize people to have a conscience and motivation to participate? You know, how do you get people to think about these issues, to read about these issues, and to participate in the development of a water system for themselves? And what I found most fascinating when I was in Bolivia is that these are questions that when I would ask, you know, how are you doing your water? You know, how are you creating these new systems? They would respond with these questions. You know, it's a constant process for them of asking questions, of engaging the community, of cultivating and building on these systems that they're creating themselves.
A lot of food for thought in Valerie Van de Pan's guest column in Model D Media, What Michigan Can Learn from Bolivia's Water Crisis. You can go to modeldmedia.com. And Valerie joined us via Skype. Valerie Van de Pan, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Cass Adair, Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Josh Hakala, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.